And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, April the 20th, 2017, 12:15 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Scott Spears along with you today on the Now program. And today we are going to delve into an issue and a topic that we have delved into many times on this program. A day that will live in infamy in the minds of many who were alive at that time, and many who have learned about it, who were born after that time, is Friday, November 22nd, 1963, 12:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. That was the time and the date that President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the 35th President of the United States, was assassinated in Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Texas. Now, many books have been written on this subject over the years by many people, some directly involved. Some implicate certain people. Some say it was Lee Harvey Oswald. Some say Jack Ruby. Some say people, names we are not familiar with. Some have said of President LBJ. There was a book written, Blood, Money, and Power, How LBJ Killed JFK. The author of that book was Barr McClellan. Barr, I'm going to let him tell this story, but has not received a lot of mainstream media attention regarding this book. But we wanted to have Barr on today, have him tell his story, how he was involved in this, and how he came to the conclusion he came to that led him to write this book. So we are very happy to welcome to our microphones today, Barr McClellan. Barr, how are you?
Well, I'm just fine, thank you. It's good to be visiting with you.
Yeah, you as well. Now, Barr, I want to start here before we get into your background. Am I right to say that mainstream media has not covered this book well?
They have not been friendly. And you may know that the History Channel had a documentary on the subject, and it got mainstream so mad that they went in and forcibly ordered the History Channel to drop it. And one of their owners said, oh, well, go ahead, drop it. So they did. So, and then they refused what I would call basic due process. I mean, in other words, they wouldn't listen to me. But that's neither here nor there. The book has been a bestseller and remains a bestseller. I'm a regular speaker at meetings, and I got a lot of audience.
Well, Barr, the interesting thing is when it comes to that History Channel documentary, I think it was The Men Who Killed Kennedy, weren't some of the people who protested at that time former President Gerald Ford and former President Jimmy Carter?
Yes, and kind of no. Now, Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission, and he altered the evidence to fit the facts they wanted to, had to have, and he didn't want it out. But Jimmy Carter said, well, let's listen to it. We might as well hear it out and see what happened. The History Channel, then at the time under attack by Jack Valenti, agreed to drop it on orders from the owner of Walt Disney, who is one of the other owners. We've got the whole story because a Kennedy family member contacted me and told me about it blow by blow. And let's put it this way, it just wasn't fair, but the story still got out, and you can still get the documentary online. And if the History Channel had any good sense, they'd take it back and start selling it again.
Well, it's interesting because you were obviously approached to be a part of this documentary, and then when the finished product is out there, all of a sudden we don't like it. I would imagine that somebody at the History Channel had to see the documentary before it hit air and didn't have any problem with it.
That's exactly right, and their historian, their resident historian, opened the documentary, saying, you know, there are a lot of theories going around still, but this is one that needs to be heard. And the staff, the people at the History Channel, wanted to keep running it, but the opposition to them was overwhelming. And I mean, you know, when the owner says drop it, what are you going to do?
Well, you know what struck me about that story, Barr, is we've done a lot of programs on this, from Jim Lavelle, who was the man handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald when he was killed, to St. John Hunt, the son of E. Howard Hunt, to Jesse Ventura's been on the program, Jim Mars has been on the program, and they've all, I mean, this is not an uncommon thing now to do a story on the assassination of President John Kennedy being a conspiracy. What struck me about your story is that so many people seem to not want it to see daylight. Those other stories do see daylight. People can discount them if they want, but they do see daylight. It's almost like they wanted to put the lid on yours. What's the explanation for that?
Well, the biggest explanation, oh, and by the way, I know those people you mentioned. I worked with them. So we had a lot of agreement going forward. But the big thing, I think, is they just don't want to take down the president, LBJ. To carry it one step further, they put up what may seem to be an impossible burden. Well, you've got to prove LBJ said he did it. Well, the furthest he went was he said, oh, there was a conspiracy. But he's never said he did it. And we've got all kinds of circumstantial evidence. And the law is on our side, because the law says if you prove a conspiracy, the conspirators have to prove they're innocent. And Johnson and his allies have done none of that. They're just putting a plain and simple lid on things, like you say. And other than they don't want to be wrong, I guess is part of it, because they've said a lot of things, too, about there not being a conspiracy. Personal pride is about the other thing, because they won't address the issues directly. They just don't.
Let's go back before any of this and talk about your growing up, your childhood, what field you were in, just to get a little background here. What was your introduction into this world in the first 20 or 30 years like?
Well, they were pretty good. I was born in Texas and traveled around, including traveling to Maracaibo, and was in an airline crash in Mexico City. And that will open your eyes, let me tell you. Managed to get out fine. Had a very good schooling, shall we say, and even got to say some words at graduation. Went on, got my law degree at Texas, and took a job in Washington to figure out how, what is called the swamp now, how it works. And I found out.
For those of us who don't know, how does that swamp work?
Lobbyists. It is so much down to personal that you can forget the law and the rules and everything. You can do what you want to do. It's I hate to have to say that it's that wide open, but it is. And it's been described as a law west of the Pecos, which means no law. Or it's been described as a kangaroo court, which is. It's just wide open, and it's really, really bad. And it's only gotten really bad. Nixon, I guess, kind of started it, although Eisenhower did something no president has ever done or shouldn't do, and that is tell the American people a lie about foreign affairs when he lied about the U-2 being shot down. Now, his friends say, oh, he was just talking. It wasn't really a lie. Not so. And we've had it ever since, and it's become, well, you see it every day now. It's become a real problem for the government of the United States. And it's what my book points out is needed, and that is some substantial reform to get back to integrity. Let me just pose one other point on that. 70% of America does not believe the Warren Report. We believe there was a conspiracy. And the reason we do that is we have integrity. The American people are very much a believer in the truth. They want to hear the truth. And they reject outright the idea that it wasn't a conspiracy. Carry it one step further, and the people defending the Warren report are 10% only. They're such a minority, they wouldn't count. And as a lawyer, I love it. There's nothing like having a jury where 90% of the jurors are on your side. So that's the way it is. And what we're trying to do, so many people that work with me and I've worked with over the years now know what happened, and we're just trying to get them past the thing of saying, well, we can't really, you know, do anything to LBJ. Well, we're keeping on working on it.
Barr, something interesting. The town we're in now is the hometown of President Warren G. Harding. Now, Warren G. Harding was a president, I think the only other president, if I'm not mistaken, who died in office in the 20th century, other than President Kennedy. Now, Warren Harding, we think, died of a heart attack. He was not assassinated. But even in that case, the story is that his wife poisoned him, that something was going on. Why are there always conspiracy theories when it comes to the rich, powerful, famous, and certainly the most powerful man in the free world, when something like this happens? Because I'm guessing that his wife did not poison him, but there's always somebody or something that comes up that, even 9/11, it didn't just happen that way.
Well, I think every time someone as powerful as a president dies, you've got to have an autopsy. You need a full report. You've got to be able to assure the people that the government is honest and is working right and is protecting us. And without that, you've got a problem. You're going to have people speculating. It's the rich and powerful kind of bring it on themselves. Maybe they're too powerful, and especially lately, because there's real talk about having a conspiracy going on all the time. And you'll find in my book that three of us, myself included, with a close tie to Rockefellers, Gordon Ferry, who is a huge and famous international financier, and Jack Worthington, who is a member of the Kennedy family, are all closely associated with this rich and powerful group, and we're the ones talking about it now. My point is, you've really got to be sure. Some of them you can pretty well shoot down. I think if you've only got 10% saved on polls, and there are polls on everything, you're pretty safe. But when you've got 10% saying, it was a one-man assassination, you got a real problem, and it sure needs an investigation. And yet the historians are just adamant about it. It's power. History is written by the survivors, among other things. And you got to knock it down, and you got to listen, and you got to investigate. And there have been plenty of investigations, but they've all stopped short. And new evidence keeps coming in, and you got to listen to it until you get it down to a reasonable number where you have America convinced. Because, again, it goes back to we Americans are pretty well dedicated to integrity. I mean, George Washington told the truth about chopping down an apple tree. We gotta have it, and yet we don't, and everybody knows it. We need to overcome that.
Barr, because I want to do a little circle here, but this is one thing about the Kennedy assassination after doing all these interviews that I've never quite understood, because I'm wide open on anything. I think it could have happened, and maybe it didn't happen. But what has left me wide open and confused is that if you're going to assassinate the most powerful man on the planet, John Kennedy, And you're going, and you're inside the government. Let's say you're Lyndon Johnson. You're vice president of the United States at the time. Now, obviously you have the power to pull it off, because if you believe that Johnson did it, then you believe that he did have the power to pull it off, because he did. But what leaves me confused is that the things that allow it to be a conspiracy theory and disbelieved by 90% of the country are the fact that it was a lone gunman. It was a guy way up in the school book depository. It was a bad gun. It was Jack Ruby shooting him 2 days later when he's being transported, where he never gets a chance to stand trial. If you're planning to murder the president and you don't want people to know it, and I'm assuming LBJ did not want people to know it if he did it, why would you be so sloppy about it?
Well, I think one thing is it's hard to avoid a little bit being sloppy. Then you've got to count on law enforcement working on your side. And this was laid out by Johnson from the very beginning. As soon as John Kennedy was elected, Johnson was planning, how am I going to take over? And we can trace that down to Assassination Day. It did not go smoothly, but it went smoothly enough that when they had law enforcement, J. Edgar Hoover backing Johnson, when you had the CIA in there backing Johnson, when you had the mafia backing Johnson, and when you couldn't present a case at all because you've done what the mafia do best and what conspirators do best is wipe out and make sure there are no dead men, because they tell no time. You've covered the case. It takes something else that I laid out in my first book, and that is a control of the legal system. And that's where I could really follow things, because my partner, Ed Clark, who was told to me arrange the assassination, he was in on it, ran the state of Texas, most powerful man in Texas, and the only man Johnson trusted. And when you can get close enough, you have to be careful, and it was careful, you get what you need. And that's what happened. It was just covered up completely, despite all the evidence to the contrary. I mean, you mentioned Gerald Ford earlier, and one of the bullet wounds was, well, it was kind of out of place, so he moved it up a little bit. You can't do that. You got to take your evidence. So while it was not, shall we say, poo perfect, it was well done and a good protection for Johnson and for the conspirators.
Barb, before we, because I want to barrel back. I want to barrel back and take people through this, but I want to go back. Where were you November 22nd, 1963.
I was in law school, and I had a newborn son, and I was at the time taking care of feeding him because I had my wife hard at work teaching school. And my mother, and she told me the president had been shot. I'm telling you, this was so naive, but my initial reaction was, we don't have anything to worry about because medicine can do wonders. And we've heard of wonders going on then. As it unfolded, it really, really began to bear down, and how awful it was became very apparent. It just never seemed to end, and I still have an emotional attraction there. I mean, because of an event I want to talk about a little later, about what happened just 4 days ago in Washington, in New York. It's still a hold on me, and I'm sure a hold on most of the people who knew about it. I can say this, that the ceremony that followed, all the ceremonies that followed, and, you know, little John saluting, that'll tear your heart. And it still does. It was a very emotional thing, I know for me, and I'm sure it was for everyone.
when the president is killed and Walter Cronkite comes across with that bulletin that he's gone, did you think at that moment that this is odd? There's something strange here? Any inclination at that point?
Yes, and the reason is, in Austin, Texas, where I was at the time, Johnson, that was his home base, and people there in Texas, in Austin, in Texas, are afraid still of the power he and his friends have. He still got friends. You know he's capable of it. There have been other killings, and while they were, you know, I hate to say just rumors, there were more than that. They were reporters there trying to follow down and uncover, but crimes can be covered unless, you know, you get law enforcement right behind you and working hard. And later, we do have one ranger who gets well behind it and gets a grand jury in Texas to say that Johnson should have been indicted for murder. But he was dead, and they couldn't do anything at the time, but they still made their ruling. So you had that. It's a fear. And I've run into that in some of the... Because I've had several people wanting to make movies of the book, and they've said it's just too hot to touch.
Now, a couple days later, when Oswald is killed by Ruby, what are you thinking then? You already have suspect in your mind that this is not up and up. Now, when that happens, see, to me, honestly, if Oswald's not killed so soon after by Jack Ruby, I think that number of people who believe in a conspiracy is probably less than half. I think that was a pivotal moment.
It was. And I think it was convincing to the 70%, among other things, but that was very convincing that the mob was somehow involved. It's just too obvious. And, you know, the excuse was, well, he felt bad for Jackie. Nobody needed to worry about Jackie. She was tougher than all of them. It was part of the decision, what I call the integrity of America, that we did not accept that step, a mafia killing. That's a gang deal, period. Or the Warren Report itself, where they have bullets doing jigsaw puzzles and moving around, and we find out later that the head snaps back instead of forward when it's supposedly hidden from behind. Hidden, you know. It doesn't stack up. And if you don't have at least, you know, some basic evidence, and they didn't, you're not going to convince anyone, and they haven't.
The killing of Lee Harvey Oswald by Jack Ruby in a public place, not even a week after the killing of JFK. Now, if you're Lyndon Johnson and your people, I mean, you have to have a brain in your head. You got to think, this doesn't look good. But the interesting thing is, I mentioned Jim Lovell earlier on, and for people who didn't hear the Jim Lovell interview, it's been about a year and a half ago here on the station. Jim Lovell is the police officer who worked in Dallas, Texas, who was in the light coat, the light jacket, that day in the picture. He's the one handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, he says there is no conspiracy. He said Oswald did it. Kind of take me through that. Why would Johnson have Oswald murdered in plain daylight like that so soon after? And why does the man who is closest to him when he dies and who is part of that transportation, to this day, I believe Jim is still alive. He's in his 90s. Believe that it was Lee Harvey Oswald.
I wish I could account for things like that. To me, if you really spend some time looking into evidence, and if Jim spends time talking to some of his friends who were there, and if you look into Oswald, you almost are convinced that he didn't do it. It's really a tough, tough question you're bringing up here. And I think the answer has to be that people have accepted over the years the conclusion that Johnson and the CIA and the FBI were able to present to America. And yet you still have, and you can ask that question, the same question you're asking, why doesn't America accept it? 70%. That's a huge number that has lasted for a long time. They don't believe it. We don't believe it. And if you spend some time looking into the evidence and talk to people who are experts with weapons, you come away convinced that there was a conspiracy. It's a very large issue. It's a very large crime. It's a very large event. And the only way I know how to do it is what any good judge would do, and that is take a look at the totality of the evidence. Look at it all honestly and come to a conclusion. And how you can get away from the conclusion there was a conspiracy, well, it's beyond me.
Barr, you mentioned a name there that I'm sure is not familiar with people. He's your former boss, Edward A. Clark. Now, who is this guy for people who don't know him? How did you get involved with him? And what was your first inclination that he had something to do with this?
Well, Edward Clark was the most powerful man in Texas, and he became that because he helped Lyndon Johnson from the very beginning, that is, from the very beginning of Johnson's political career, which started in 1937 when he was elected to the Congress. Well, it even started before then. But they were very good friends, and Clark was, in writing, you can see it, he was ready to be a patsy for Johnson. In other words, if Johnson gets in trouble, Clark's going to take the fall, and he can do it behind the lawyer privilege. He doesn't have to say anything about who did it, really. And Clark was anything but an honest man. I mean, he was stealing from the United States Army in 1942 in the Quartermaster's Corps, for which he was kicked out of the Army. Later, he gets in a position where he can control the judges, and he starts with the DA in Austin, gives him the position, which he could do, because of his political influence at the time. I mean, this was right during the war, and all the able-bodied men were all fighting. Clark had gotten himself kicked out for stealing. Take your choice. But he worked with Johnson and got him and helped him steal the 1948 Senate election. There, a man was killed, too, to keep him shut up. And the governor of Texas said it was murder by Johnson, but never pursued it. So Clark and Johnson are working hand in glove, and they have another murder. Now, this one was tried in Austin, and the guy, for cold-blooded murder, was given a suspended sentence, and he went to work for the military industrial complex in Dallas, a guy named Mac Wallace. But Clark stays with Johnson all through this, and there is a revealing letter in the file, in the book, where Johnson writes Clark and says, "You're the only man I trust. I am grateful for everything to you." And when you have that kind of a relationship, I think you've got it nailed down. By that I mean Clark ran, or could run, or the two could work together. Let's put it that way. The two work together very closely. Then I'm told when I go to work, sign on with Clark, he takes me on as a lawyer, and I'm told by one of his partners that Clark arranged the assassination. Well, this is the kind of thing that you can talk about among lawyers. You know, you go into the lawyers' offices and deep mahogany and everything is secret, but those guys, we knew what was going on. And I thought I was bound by the attorney-client privilege too. But I stuck with him and helped him, and this is where it really became the key, when he collected on the fee for the assassination, got himself an oil well, and then more from Rockefeller. Now, when you when you're working at that level, you're finding out a whole lot of stuff. Fake lawsuits, whatever you want to call it. And it's probably a good friend has said it's the most convincing part of the case. And what goes on from there is Clark comes to me and says, you've got to help me with this guy. I mean, he's just awful, and they're charging him with crimes and everything. And I said, I'm not touching him. He stole oil, and you got to understand, this is the way it happens in Texas. He stole oil from San Antonio and gave it to Dallas. Well, you know, how can you steal oil? Well, he did. And I won the case for our clients at the time. And it was a big case. And it's the kind of power that Clark had, and it was kind of connections you can make with Rockefeller. Exxon was the beneficiary in such a big way. But carry it a step further, and I have to leave him because I don't represent the guy. He said, you got to represent the guy. And I said, I'm not doing it. And we parted company not long after that. Then he does what he typically does to keep people shut up, is he calls a note, and we go to court. This city for 10 years. Ultimately, everything's thrown out. And today, I don't know if you can call it rewarded or what, but Clark's law firm is gone. It was closed for corruption, and he's not a problem. But it's that kind of relationship where I learned how he controlled and with a phone call could win a case or lose a case. And that's the kind of swamp I was talking about in Washington. There are some lawyers that can do that, and he did it. And I was the beneficiary several times. But at least I parted company with him and can now say, look, if you guys think you can get away with that, then I can too. I think I got angry. And in an affidavit in 1984, said what I was told, that Clark had arranged the assassination, and it's been going on ever since.
Was that something you could have ever brought up to him?
What was that?
With Clark. You were told that he arranged the assassination.
Right.
Right. Is that something that you ever talked with him directly about?
No. I had parted company with him by then.
Oh, this was after.
What
okay.
I've been told, though, on several occasions was that, you know, this is a deal for Dallas. We did things for people in Dallas, and I know who he's talking about, that, it's a great deal. We brought this lawsuit. It's a fake lawsuit. We did it because we had to help Rockefeller, this kind of thing. It wasn't something you talked about every day, and it sure wasn't broadcast or talked around the fireplace or over whiskey or anything like that. But the only way I knew to bring it out was in a direct conflict with him to say what I, and put it in an affidavit to see where it went.
Now, LBJ, he rose to be president of the United States. He rose to be vice president. But what makes this politician in Texas such a powerful guy? Just a knockdown, drag-out type of guy who ultimately would have the power to murder the president.
It's part of what was going on in Texas. You know, the law west of the Pecos, judge what he wanted to, but it goes a lot deeper than that, because when I put my book out, and what happened and what I found was a lot of people had answers. They just didn't know the questions. So my book goes out, and I get an email from a guy who says, everything in your book is accurate. and he turned out to be a Kennedy member, a Kennedy family member, and ideally, as it turned out, the family member of a Maverick family, which was based in San Antonio, and it had relations with a family in Eagle Pass, now we're going, which was the Smuggler's Hole. And all this is set out to show how Johnson and Clark worked with these people on the other side. Mavericks, everybody knows Maverick, nice, honest, decent guy. Bibbs, they controlled the border, they worked with Mexico, and then they fell in with transporting drugs and people and weapons into Mexico for Cuba. And that's when it took a turn for the worst. They set up a bank there, the Frontier Bank, and moved all this material for money into Cuba and became closely associated with the Mafia. George DeMoren Shield went down there. It was a crime zone, and it's been what's called the Smuggler's Hole all these years. But these guys knew each other and knew about each other, and where I found out was a fellow you may know, Doug Caddy, referred Jack Worthington to me. And Jack Worthington in that family. And he told me what had happened. He knew the Bibb family well, and he had been told by his mother that John Kennedy was his father. And Scott, he looked like him, he acted like him, he thinks like him, but the Kennedys couldn't do the DNA. When Jack couldn't get it done through Vanity Fair, well, actually, Vanity Fair said, yeah, we've got the DNA, but then they got word from above that they couldn't use it. So he asked me what we could do, and I said, well, we can always try the old-fashioned way. If we can't get DNA, we just take the baby to the jury, hold it up, and ask them if they think that this baby is the son of this father. It's a great way to move ahead. It turned out we didn't have to do that because Jack is very wealthy in his own right. And he said, I just don't need to do this anymore. I know what I know. Jack, though, and here you mentioned earlier about what do I remember? Jack is in the enviable position of trying to find out who his father is because he didn't know anything about it. He'd gone to Australia International Finance, based in Mexico, but he could tell me how through his family, the Bibb family in the Smuggler's Hole area, worked through all those people. And after Johnson died, here's where we really can nail it down, is the Frontier Bank, which had the Mafia and the CIA and others on its board of directors, were indicted, and they were set for trial. And they were represented by Ed Clark. So the circle is pretty well complete there. And how many of these you need to have to make the whole case? Well, every one of them counts. And this one is part of that totality of the evidence you've got to look at. So the Frontier Bank was the one. And working with the Mafia and the CIA and invading Cuba and these sort of things, which... stick with me now, it becomes very important later, but it's a part of this totality of evidence, and you've got to see that as possible in Texas because of Clark's ability to control the courts down there, and a banana republic was what it was, and I think it's still, well, I know it was still there when I was there, but it pretty well dissipated, I think. I mean, the judges have passed on and been replaced and this sort of thing. But that's the kind of thing you have when you've got a control of the legal system. And Washington still does it.
do want to let people know we're chatting with Barr McClellan, author of Blood, Money, and Power, How LBJ Killed JFK. We're going to come up on a break here in about 6 minutes. It'll be about a 10-minute break for news and weather. Barr is going to stick with us and come back with us on the other side of that. In the last 20 minutes today, I want to let people know, former HBO boxing analyst Larry Merchant will be on with us at 1:40 p.m. Eastern Time to discuss Bill O'Reilly leaving Fox News. But Barr, in the remaining time in this hour, how did LBJ become Vice President of the United States, and did the Kennedys realize he had this in him, this killing, murdering streak?
The answer to the second one is yes. And they told him, he was told by Bobby to always keep his eye on him. Johnson came into it because they needed the Southern vote for JFK to win the election in 1960. New evidence has come in through Gordon Perry, who I mentioned earlier, a lawyer extraordinary, a financier extraordinary, and a member, a Marine sniper, who was the top gun and who was on the presidential detail, and who knew, of course, John Kennedy, and even rode horses with Jackie, found out that his financing partner, a fellow named of Elliot, who was the top guy with the Democratic Party, he was the one who was at the deal that was made in L.A., in Los Angeles, in 1960, for Johnson to take the vice presidency. He didn't want to, but they made him an offer he couldn't refuse, and he took it. With that done, of course, you could go ahead and have the election. They had the election, and John Kennedy could barely win, but it was what he needed. He had to have the South, and Johnson could bring him that, and he did. It was a deal made for money, a lot of it, too, talking about $4 million and $4 million. And Johnson thought he could take it and still become president, because it was pointed out to him by his good buddy Sam Rayburn, who was then Speaker of the House, that you're just a heartbeat away from the presidency. Johnson took it, and he thought he could govern with John Kennedy on the same level. In fact, my book has a picture of John Kennedy at the LBJ Ranch 7 days after the election, and that's when he was introduced to this woman who looked just like Jackie, who has the affair with him and who has the baby. And people say, you ain't got no proof. Yeah, you do. I got the guy. Here's my baby, a grown man now. But this is John Kennedy's son. Again, you ask why they won't, you know, admit Johnson may have been involved. Well, some things they're just not going to admit, and that's one of them. But it's all there. And Gordon, who came to my attention and who has been working with me ever since, is finishing up a book on Johnson also, and it's due out soon, and it's going to be called Evil. And it's going to be about how really, really bad Johnson is. And this is all in the works. And just, Scott, just let me add this one little footnote here. This is a very appropriate time because John Kennedy's birthday is coming up on the 29th of May, and it would be his 100th, and it's time we got justice for his family, because the Kennedys have suffered. Right now, the historians are rewriting history, trying to make Johnson look better, bigger, and more successful than John Kennedy. really, 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 really inexcusable. And that needs to be reversed and stopped. And fortunately, with Jack Worthington, we're able to do it. And it's happening right now. How much time do we have? Can
well, we
I tell
have
you
about,
one little story?
Yeah, we have about 2 minutes left in this segment. Go ahead.
I had lunch in the Metropolitan Club in New York last Friday with Gordon Ferry and Jack Worthington. And Jack wanted to know, could you tell me some about my father? And I said, Jack, there's one thing you need to know about that was momentous. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, war was started. Gordon was in charge of the Marine detachment that he sent ashore. The markers had already been sent in to show the way. War had started. I mean, when you invade another country's land, you got a war. Apparently, there was a little shooting. Not much. But then the word came down, stop. And I could look at Jack, and I teared up, and he did too, because at that very moment, the start of World War III had actually started and ended. It was a kind of heroic, well, it was heroic on the part of John Kennedy, because the military had been pushing him so hard, insisting he go to war, and he stopped it. And you know, I'm very thankful for that. We all should be. And we, Jack and I, had this emotional connection. I don't know if you can feel it, but we were on the brink and went over it and were pulled back.
The guest
and
is.
Thank John Kennedy for that.
The
and
guest
if that
is.
That doesn't make him one of the great presidents. Then you can ask the historians, how do they measure success as a president? Because in my mind, John Kennedy is one heroic president.
The guest is
being treated very badly.
The guest is Barr McClellan. We are going to take about an 8-minute break here, come back with Barr, and talk about the day that John Kennedy was killed. How did it all happen, and why was it Vice President Lyndon Johnson? Stay with us. We're coming back.
Street.
Programming on WWGH Radio is supported by the Central Ohio Farmers Co-op for Prairie, serving